The following is offered by Discerning Hearts, a 501c3 nonprofit Catholic apostolate dedicated to spiritual formation through the use of new media. To download this selection, or to browse hundreds of other programs, or to contribute to our mission with a charitable donation which is fully tax deductible, visit our website at discerninghearts.com.
Ignatius Press and the Augustine Institute present The Formed Book Club. Catholic book lovers unpacking good books, chapter by chapter. If you like us, please help us by subscribing and by reviewing us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you might listen. And don't forget to sign up for weekly updates and study questions at formedbookclub.ignatius.com.
Welcome to the Formed Book Club. Perhaps welcome back to the Formed Book Club, but for those who may be new here, we are your co-hosts, Father Joseph Fessio, S.J., Stephen Dudrow, and Joseph Pierce. Coming to you from San Francisco and South Carolina, we're going to return to Thomas Howard, Chants of the Dance. And the we've covered beginning front matter and also chapter one and chapter two. I mean, Chants of the Dance refers to two different views or myths, they could be called, of reality. Is reality merely the haphazard interaction of small particles? Or are things really more than collections of particles? Are they objects which are related to each other, all in a great cosmic chain of being? So are things merely by chance and particulate, or are we actually different types of beings that are connected to each other? That was in the first chapter. The old myth and the new covers that. Old myth being connection, the new myth being particles unconnected. Chapter 2 of Dishrags and Borzois showed how in our everyday life, our imagination is the faculty by which we organize things to see significance in them, and we see connections, so that I'm feeling limp as a dish rag is connecting my feeling of inner weariness to a dish rag. Now we go on to Lunch and Death, where he talks about ritual, which is a particular use of the imagination to organize our experience in a way that's ceremonial. And then we'll get up maybe to chapter 4, One Foot Up, One Foot Down, which is another way the imagination organizes our experience linguistically as poetry. So, Vivian or Joseph, do you want to give us something to begin with on chapter 3 of Lunch and Death?
Well, in the second paragraph on page 25, it's the first page of the chapter, it says, if we scrutinize the way we do things, we shall find that we have festooned everything with formality, and that nearly every act is loaded down with gestures that bespeak much more than can be discerned in the functional demands of the situation itself. And he uses an example, the shaking of hands, and then calls it, it is pure ceremony, all right, as in ritual. And I completely agree with him, obviously, but I want to be a bit more fundamentalist in it, in the sense that every word is something which speaks of something beyond itself. Every gesture is something that speaks of something beyond itself. In other words, that our very existence is only possible in terms of meaning, in terms of allegory, that which speaks of something beyond itself, whether it be a gesture, as in the shaking of hands, or in every single word that we use. So in other words, that there's a metaphysical dimension to our understanding of anything. So reality, if you like, is rooted in metaphysics. Unless you believe, of course, that it's all a random movement of particles, in which case, of course, how on earth is anybody even thinking about a thing such as meaning?
I agree that you've gotten more granular in what you've done there, and I think it's important to do just that. I think it's helpful the way he writes this, though, for ordinary readers to demonstrate it by something less granular, like shaking hands or lunch, because that's not a specific word. It's a gesture. Lunch is more than a gesture, but that The fact is, as he says, just above where you began your citation there, Joseph, on page 25, on all levels, from the lunch table to the coronation, we dispose our experience ritually. And I think you're bringing out this fact that it points beyond itself, but clearly setting the table for lunch points way beyond digesting food, you know, ingesting food. We do need a
tablecloth. I would actually argue as well, Father, that shaking hands is an explicit ritualistic acceptance of the love of neighbor, of the dignity of the human person, of the fact that we are not merely something to be trodden on or treated with indifference. So, you know, so something as automatic and thoughtless, in the sense that we do it without thinking about it, actually conveys a deep sense of significance, in the sense that we are human persons. We are not a piece of dust. And what does that imply? Therefore, we treat each other with a ritual which displays that dignity.
Of course, now it's seen as an attack, unless you have latex gloves on or definitely sanitize your hands prior to the event.
I mean, it is a point, without getting on, without taking that tangent too far, that there are all sorts of attacks upon the dignity of the human person and upon individual liberty that are tangential consequences of our present situation.
On page 31, he explains a little further what we're doing here with the handshake or the lunch setting, and that is we handle our experience in a way that both imposes upon and draws from it significance. It is, in a word, a matter of form and content, of taking the plain stuff of experience, that's the content, and organizing it ritually, that's the form. It is the signal of our, a little dropping down a few lines, it is the signal of our awareness that things are worth something, that they are significant. We dignify the merely utilitarian. We seek a heightened consciousness of experience via form. We move through our experience like figures in a solemn dance. There's that key word from the title. For we are such creatures as hanker for significance, and we suspect that significance emerges only and always from the union of form and content. And I would like to add that, you know, that's the definition of a sacrament. You need form and matter in order to effect, to signify something and effect what it signifies. So that,
I actually have the same section highlighted here, Vivian, and the sentence is the signal of our awareness that things are worth something, that they are significant. In other words, that the reason to signification is merely that one of the things points to something else. But the key thing is that they are worth something. In other words, that these things have value. That they're not merely something which is utilitarian. It's merely something which is useful. No, they have an intrinsic value, and the outward sign is a signification of that value.
I think that one of the great benefits of what he does in this book is to draw our attention to the fact that we are ritual beings. We may not think so if we think of ritual as being, you know, going to religious service, but shaking hands, eating lunch, almost everything we do, even on the street, good morning. What do you mean, good morning? What does that mean, good morning? You know, is it good or is it not good? Is it a question? Is it a statement? Well, no, we have taken our experience and given it a form so that we illustrate its value, its worth.
Father, dare I ask you if what you just said is a sort of paraphrase of a great work of literature by a writer that we both love?
I'm sure it is, because most of the things
in The Hobbit,
most things they were paraphrases of someone else.
Now, in The Hobbit, Gandalf basically, that Frodo Baggins says to Gandalf, "Good morning," in a way which really means "go away." and then Gandalf said, "What do you actually mean by good morning? That it's good, you know? And what do you mean by good?" And it's a wonderful, you know, metaphysical reflection on the way we use words thoughtlessly.
Well, that's really interesting, Joseph, because it reminds me then of what John Paul II said in his Theology of the Body, that because these gestures and words do in fact mean something, if you use them to say the thing they don't mean, you are engaged in an act of dishonesty. And the example that he uses is when Judas kisses Jesus to betray him. And saintly John Paul II says, we instantly know that this is a lie. So you can now, you know, apply this to other things in life. If you say good morning and what you really mean is go away, right? But you wouldn't know that it didn't mean what it meant to mean if it didn't mean something.
Right. Now, that's a very, very good example, which hammers home the truth that I was, and Tolkien and Father were trying to...
This recalls to me a poem that I heard, a limerick, I suppose, when I was very young. Do not tell me about your indigestion. How are you is a greeting, not a question.
Bravo.
Very good. I wouldn't say one thing. If we can go back one, just a couple of pages.
Sure.
Page 28, bottom paragraph, just one sentence here, which I think is very important. Any criticism of ritual arrives not from a non-ritualist, parentheses, there are none,
yes,
but only from another sort of ritual. So the important thing is, it's not as if we have a choice here between being a ritualist and not being a ritualist. We are all ritualists. Is it what rituals and what rites do we think are important is the only difference, right? So in other words, on a primal level, whether we are radical relativists, Marxists, trad Catholics, Nazis, whatever, we are all ritualists. In other words, something inherent in who we are as human beings that needs this ritual and cannot actually work in terms of any meaning whatsoever without it.
And there's a parallel there to being dogmatic. People don't like dogmatic people, but the point is, everyone's dogmatic. It's just a question of which dogma you happen to hold.
Right.
So which rituals do you use? I always enjoy it when this happens, but it's happened almost perfectly this chapter. When every time one of you wants to quote something, it's a passage that I've already underlined.
Yes, I agree. That happens to me,
I find that
too.
So often. And that last thing, I would just, you know, I've said this many times and you're probably getting bored with it, but it's one of those motifs that come back to me. Oscar Wilde, you know, that a cynic is one who knows the price of everything and the value of nothing. This is really about reality being something which has value, and only a cynic can pretend otherwise, and they're a hypocrite because they still have their own sense of values.
Before we leave this chapter, you know, this, what on earth does death have to do with it? And you think you know where he's going. Well, of course, we ceremonialize death with funerals and so on. But even before he gets to that, on page 34, he talks about death itself being the most arresting of all instances in human experience of the divorce of form and content. And this is why it's so grotesque.
Yes. It's if death is a violation of something which is deeper than death itself.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Wow, that really, I don't know about you, but that just...
Yeah.
No, that struck me also. Yeah.
We'll return to the Form Book Club with Father Joseph Fezzio, Vivian Doudreau, and Joseph Pierce in just a moment. Did you know that Discerning Hearts has a free app in which you can find all your favorite Discerning Hearts programming? Father Timothy Gallagher, Dr. Anthony Lillis, Deacon James Keating, Mike Aquilina, Dr. Matthew Bunsen, and so many more are found on the Discerning Hearts free app. Did you also know that you can stream Discerning Hearts programming on numerous streaming platforms such as Apple Podcasts, Google Play, iHeartRadio, Pandora, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, and so many more? And did you know that Discerning Hearts also has the YouTube page? Be sure to check out all these different places where you can find Discerning Hearts.
Take, Lord, and receive all my liberty, my memory, my understanding, and my entire will, all that I have and call my own. You have given all to me. To you, Lord, I return it. Everything is yours. Do with it what you will. Give me only your love and your grace. That is enough for me. Amen.
Hello, my name is Deacon Omar Gutierrez, and I want to ask you to support Discerning Hearts in a special way. We, Chris McGregor, the board, and I all know that not everyone listening can help financially. We know we have listeners from all parts of the world, and we have made a commitment since the beginning to make the truths shared through Discerning Hearts totally free. So while you may not be able to contribute financially, what you can do is certainly pray, but also give us positive reviews on whatever platform you use to listen to us. If it's iTunes, Android, Stitcher, Spotify, however it is that you get these podcasts, or if you're on YouTube and you like our videos, please give us a good rating and write a review. The more good ratings and reviews we get, the higher our profile, and the more listeners will discover us, listeners who may have the means to contribute in the future. Please consider rating us and writing a positive review today.
We now return to the Formed Book Club with Father Joseph Bezzio, Vivian Doudreau, and Joseph Pierce.
So we move on to chapter 4.
Okay.
This great classic poem, One Foot Up, One Foot Down. That's the way to London Town.
I might add here that, you know, that nursery rhyme begins with Seesaw Sacredown, which is the way to London Town. Meaning a person is asking a question on the way how to get somewhere. And somewhat cheekily, the person answers, One foot up and one foot down, this is the way to London Town. Which is not exactly the answer that the person asking the question
did. I didn't know that.
Although actually it is the most practical example, one step at a time is basically what the answer is. And that's
exactly the way forward,
right?
Exactly. I mean, it's the more fundamental answer, but it's not telling him we'll turn right at the next intersection
right.
or something like that, you know? So in any case, I couldn't help reading this chapter, putting that in the context of the whole nursery rhyme. One that I sang to my children over and over again. I sang all my children nursery rhymes when they were little. And now my granddaughter, too. And it was just such a delight for me to see him take a nursery rhyme and weave this magical chapter around it.
Yes. I mean, he does what Chesterton so often does. He takes something ordinary and leads you into realizing that it's not ordinary at all. It's extraordinary.
Yes.
He begins this chapter on page 39 and telling us what he's doing, where he's going. We have been talking about how we organize experience ceremonially. That was the last chapter. Poetry is to do this in language. So he's really addressing the same fundamental human reality here from different angles. But to point to the fact that why do we do this? Is it because we're just exercising some kind of flight of escapist fancy? Or is it that we recognize that this is the way things are? Because that's really the fundamental lesson of this book. What is the way things are? Are things merely haphazard chance collisions of particles? Or is reality a dance in which all the figures have roles to play related to each other?
One thing, Father, that really strikes me here, that he takes a fairly relatively trivial poem, right? One which is a nursery rhyme, One Foot Up, One Foot Down, which actually conveys within it the whole understanding of metrics in actual fact, but not anything which is too deep. But then he basically says that in these two lines, the poetry is conveying something which is deeper than all the things we think is important. And then he lists on page 41, Bear in mind this is being written originally, at least, 1969, okay? We suspect that there is a view possible, that it is a view not far from the truth of the matter, that will see the great wars and political campaigns and current agonies as squalls on the surface of human existence, and that whether the issue of the moment is Attila the Hun or the South Sea bubble or taxation without representation or apartheid, there are constants in human experience that lie underneath these. Now, of course, we find ourselves in the midst of a very contentious election. We find ourselves in the midst of all sorts of darkness in all sorts of ways, COVID, et cetera, and its ramifications. But these are things that are absolutely crucial to us now. But apartheid isn't. It was, right, before it passed. Taxation without representation is an absolute principle. It's absolutely true. But this relates to a certain thing in history. Attila the Hun, of course, if you were in his wake, then you knew it, right? But these are all absolutely very real, but they are in some sense accidental or transcendent. Whereas taking life one step up, one step down to get to London town or Rome or heaven, all right, is actually stating something much more fundamental than all these momentous things that are momentous, but they're of the moment.
Yes.
Amen.
G.K. Chesterton says somewhere, I don't know which book, that one reason why Italian governments are always in a state of disarray is because the Italians know there are more important things than governments.
Good old Chesterton.
You know? Yep.
It's like the German couple where the husband said, look, dear, I'm going to take care of foreign policy, economic taxation policies, the exchange rate, and the banking system. You take care of lunch, please.
Which is actually, that's the home front. It's not unimportant, right?
I want to go back to page 39, about eight lines from the bottom, where he says, in both cases, poetry and ceremony, a new thing has appeared from the union of form and content, a thing which arrays the materials in such a way as to yield a sense of significance, a significance not foreign to those materials, but rather inherent in them. Again, it's not some kind of artificial clothing experience with some kind of frills, but rather bringing out some inherent value and beauty in the experience itself.
And we need art to do this. You know, if we don't have art, whether, and he talks about visual art later on, but the art of language, which the highest form is poetry, the art of ritual, if we don't have these things, then the true significance of these things has a way of escaping us, right? Art is the way that we take that moment to see through the vision of the artist what's really there.
And that's, he says on page 40, top of the page, where it is in poetry that human speech makes a supreme effort to approximate what our imagination leads us to suspect is, in fact, the way things are.
Yes.
Yeah.
If I could connect that, Father, to page 45, where he basically says the same thing, using different metaphorical language, middle of the page. It is imagination that plants in us, in the first place, the idea that the turning may be robbing us of our only chance to live, unless we find out that at the center of every turning, there is a still point, and that we move toward that point in whose stillness there are held all the turnings that seem so helter-skelter to us. In other words, you know, life is full of movement. Right, it's full of a helter-skelter, full of chaos, or what might appear to be chaos, of change, of turmoil, of squalls on the surface. And yet the purpose of poetry is to look for that still point upon which everything else turns, right? That pivot, that stillness. And, you know, of course, Eliot is superb at this and others. But that's the whole point, is that we are, the word point.
Here, yes. Right?
So the whole point is that where is the point upon which everything else turns?
And that itself is an example of images, the turning point in which all these things moving, you know, find their rest.
And he uses the image of Don Quixote in front of the windmill.
Yeah, that's right.
Image. So, you know, we've got an image on top of an image on top of an image, all helping us to grasp something there that without art, we might not notice it.
Well, I've got something on page 52, which is not a disagreement with Thomas Howard, but maybe trying to distill what he's saying. So he gives a very useful four things that poetry can do for us on page 52, about 10 lines down. Resolution, recurrence, recognition, and transfiguration, which he then discusses over the next several pages. But I would suggest that all of these really are means to the end. And the end is to seek order or design or meaning or purpose. In other words, all of these things are there as means to vanquish the void with some sort of substance, which is proves the absence of the void. If you like, music, in the broadest sense of the word, that which comes from the muse, is to show us this harmony, this order in the cosmos, which shows us a sense of proportion and order and design and meaning. And these things which he references here are means to that end.
Yes.
Right, but I do think they are four different approaches, four different perspectives of that appreciation of order.
Agreed. They're means to the end.
Also, what he does is he shows us that we actually take delight in this experience of this recognition of the pattern, the order, the meaningfulness, and so on. In other words, and I think that's the brilliance of using the nursery rhyme in this chapter. You know, we don't need sophisticated art. We don't need this high level in order to experience the delight he's talking about. You can experience the delight of the order of things by a simple nursery rhyme. And that, I think, is a really important point to get across. That you know, you don't have to be a shallow sophisticate. You could just
the nursery rhyme here would serve as a metaphor for the sunrise, or the Bethlehem star, which hope to get out and see this evening before it's too late. You know, I mean, the wonder and order and harmony and beauty and the dance is present all around us. You know, a nursery rhyme can show us that as well as the greatest of the sonnets. It's
exactly
a different way of showing the same simplicity.
Exactly.
On page 59, five lines down, the little glimpse of life in that verse is a glimpse into a picture where the necessities of life dance in a pattern of harmonious activity. Again, that's another... He's coming at this different descriptions, but it's all leading to the same thing, but it's true. I want to conclude my part whenever it gets to that point of the last two pages, 1661, because he says some beautiful things there, but either of you want to have any comment before that?
No.
I want to say one thing very briefly on the Divine Comedy, the references in the paragraph at the end of the bottom page 60 there.
Okay.
This is part of the business of poetry, from the nursery rhyme to the Divine Comedy. That, for instance, the Divine Comedy, unlike a nursery rhyme, perhaps, is a stupendous work of architecture, like a Gothic cathedral in verse. And the fact that Dante builds that with his own rhyme scheme that he invents for the purpose, the Terza Rima, which is robust, which holds the whole thing together like a chain link fence. Shows that, you know, that the order and harmony in art is actually connected to rules, right? It doesn't happen by magic or by anarchy or by just, you know, letting your feelings do what they want to do. You have to say, what am I trying to achieve here? And in Dante's case, it was this edifice, which is the poetic equivalent of a Gothic cathedral. Well, what can I build it with? I have to find a form that's actually going to be give it the structure it needs to be able to hold up, like a Gothic piece of a Gothic architecture. So he invents a rhyme scheme, Tetrarima, which is so robust that it holds the whole thing together from the first line in the Inferno to the final line in the Paradiso. In other words, that there's a brilliance, it's ultimately divine, in the way that the muse works.
Very good. And that's where I was going to begin, on bottom of page 60 there. We're continuing from where you spoke, Joseph. The business of poetry addresses our imagination, and with everything that it is at its service, it tries to beguile us into the intense awareness of experience. Again, trying to help us see that things are more profound than we often recognize in daily life. But I had a little image of my own came recently. You've heard the famous thing about standing on the shoulders of giants, and you can see farther. And of course, it's almost like a pyramid of men. We think about, you know, Augustine stands on Plato, and Thomas stands on Augustine, and Balthasar stands on Thomas, and we stand on him. But if you're standing like that and looking at the earth, you can see a wider and wiser horizon. But at a certain point, no matter how high you get, you can only see half of the surface of the sphere. The other half, you're never going to see. And so this is kind of how writers and theologians and spiritual, you know, men and women of our history help us to see more and more of the divine mystery. But it's always the surface. We know there's three dimensions to it, but we can't see that directly. But the more we see the surface, the more we recognize there's more underneath that surface. And yet we're never gonna be able to, no matter how many shoulders we stand on, we're never gonna see the other side until we get to the other side. But continuing here, that's my little metaphor. The bottom of the page, but it does not call us away from the real world of function into a garden of fancy that never existed anywhere. Rather, poetry's high office is to ransom us from thrall to the deadly myth that life is cluttered and obstructed by necessity, and to return us to life with the awareness that it is packed with glory, and that the clutter of daily experience that we ordinarily apprehend as just that, clutter, may on the contrary be the epiphany of form, of the very order and harmony and serenity that we long for in our reveries. That's beautiful. Mm-hmm. Anything else on this chapter on poetry from our great poet here, Joseph?
I think the way you've just concluded chapter four is a perfect way of doing so. Obviously, we haven't got as far as we might have hoped, but that's not anything unusual in the Form Book Club. If you want to give the readings for next time and also to tell people we're having a little bit of a Christmas break.
All right. Yeah, that's right. So we'll move on to soup cans next time. And let's see the table of contents here. So we'll take chapters 5 and chapter 6. And let's read chapter 7 just in case we get three chapters in one sitting. So that'll be next session, but we will take a little break, a Christmas break, and be back the week after Christmas. Thanks, everyone. God bless you, and have a blessed Christmas.
Merry Christmas, everybody.
And Happy New Year.
If you enjoyed this discussion, please help spread the word about the Form Book Club by subscribing to the podcast and writing a review. You can sign up for weekly updates at formedbookclub.ignatius.com.